Good evening. This is Lisa Gar, and I'll be your host tonight on Coast to Coast. So relax, enjoy. We're going to be together under the stars tonight, actually, literally. There's a Perseid meteor shower tonight. There actually is not going to be any moon. It's a new moon. So it's going to be a great night to take a look. If you can get into a dark place and look at the sky, it's going to be a beautiful meteor shower. So enjoy that. Apparently, according to NASA, the source of the meteor shower is this comet Swift Tuttle, and it intersects the Earth orbit tonight with tiny bits of little comet dust hitting the Earth's atmosphere at 132,000 miles per hour, which is what we see as a shooting star, that vivid streak of light. So check that out. Now that I have told you to go outside, come back, or bring your radio with you, because you don't want to miss tonight's show. Later tonight, I'm going to be talking with one of my favorite people, Dr. Bruce Lipton. He's a cellular biologist who talks about the cellular biology of positive thought, and that our genes and our DNA do not control the biology. Instead, our DNA is controlled by signals outside of our environment, in our immediate environment. So in other words, we may not have to be victims of our own genetics. It's an interesting concept. Have you ever found yourself saying, oh, heart disease runs in my family, or mental illness is genetic? Well, maybe you don't actually have to be signed up for that particular case of doom and gloom. And what we're going to be talking about later is some of the new sciences say maybe you're just not destined for that same fate. So then the conversation is going to get great. We're going to go out there and beyond. Bruce is going to talk about how all of this applies to human evolution. So it's going to be terrific. And then did you know there is a new movie coming out August 17th from Warner Brothers called The 11th Hour. It's an environmental documentary, and it's produced and narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. I got the chance to see a screening the other night, and it's very good. It's kind of along the lines of An Inconvenient Truth, but not so much about global warming. It's more about the environmental crisis that we're in right now, and it has scientists and 54 different people, biochemists. They're talking. There's a very cool technology they talk about called biomimicry, and it mimics the way nature creates the environment and duplicates itself. It's fascinating. And so that they create the same effect in a lab, but it really is interesting stuff. So we're going to be talking about that later and find out why so many people in this movie really feel we are at a tipping point in terms of our environmental situation, as some people call it, an environmental crisis, and that we as the human race are facing an extinction crisis along with all other life. So stay tuned for that interview later. Paul Hawken is going to be my guest. He's one of the scientists from the film. So first, let's talk about why any of this is important. We know that there's a hurricane coming in towards Hawaii. It's strengthening. It's strengthened to a Category 4 storm Saturday, yesterday, and it's spun more than 1,000 miles south of Hawaii, but it's going that way right now as we speak. And it intensified with the maximum sustained winds near 132 miles per hour. It started off at 12. And this is common, where it starts off slow and then it moves and then it decreases and increases. But this one right now is on its way to increasing right now. The islands usually get an average of 4.5 tropical cyclones a year and one hurricane about every 15 years. And last year, the Central Pacific had 5 cyclones after the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicted 2 or 3. So there are definitely things going on in our environment. As a matter of fact, we have the head of NASA joining us. This is very exciting. The Meteoroid Environment Office, Bill Cook, he is the head of this particular office at NASA. He's with us to tell us a little bit about the meteor shower going on overhead right now. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Doing fine. How are you doing?
Oh, great, great. Where are you calling us from?
Huntsville, Alabama.
Well, thanks for being available on such a quick, short notice. So what's going on out there? Exactly what is this meteor shower? It happens every time around this year?
Yes. The Perseid
of year around this time, sorry.
The Perseids happen mid-August of every year, and that's when we run into icy debris left behind by comet Swift Tuttle. And this stuff hits the atmosphere moving at over 30 miles per second, and when the little pieces of ice, which are about the size of a millimeter, think of a ruler and the little millimeter marks on it, these things burn up and leave a brilliant piece of a brilliant flash of light we call a shooting star or a meteor.
They're that small?
They're that small.
That's amazing. And so Why is it that this happens? It's from the same comet, right?
Yeah, but you think of the orbit, and the Earth's orbit intersects the orbit of that comet about this time every year.
Okay.
So imagine a ring of comet dust, and this time every year the Earth runs into that ring of comet dust.
And it's just constantly there. Well, this is going to be, especially tonight, because there's not going to be a moon out. People can take a look up and see this meteor shower right around this time. It happened from 9 to 10 Pacific time, so around 1:30 right now in Eastern time. So it's definitely on display. So that's exciting. Is there is this a specific season that you might see from July to August more meteor showers than any other time?
Well, the Perseids are the second best meteor shower of the year. Most people like it because it's a nice warm summer night. They can go out and observe meteors without it being cold and them freezing. So the Perseids are generally the meteor shower people know best. And the best shower, of course, is the Geminids, but that's in middle December and it's very cold. No one wants to be out after midnight on a midwinter night.
Mm-hmm. But where are you? Are you in your office?
Yes, I am.
You're going to have a good show tonight and report on it tomorrow for us. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining. We will take a look at that. Remember, people, if you're going to go outside, bring your radio because we've got a good show coming for you tonight. Thanks a lot, Bill Cook from the NASA Meteoroid Environments Office. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. All right. Well, we've just talked about some various changes in the weather. There's hurricanes, there's floods going on. So maybe these are isolated incidents, and maybe they're not. Maybe they're pieces of a larger global puzzle that could really unlock a lot of answers and questions about the future of our planet. So when I come back, we'll be talking with Paul Hawken. He's one of the environmentalists from the documentary The 11th Hour. You're listening to Lisa Garr, and this is Coast to Coast AM. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. This is Lisa Garr, your host for the evening. By the way, I loved hearing from you guys the last time I was on the air. Please email me. I liked your comments. I like hearing such a great audience on Coast to Coast because you guys are so active and interactive with the hosts. So they gave me an email address. It's lisagarr@coasttocoastam.com. So let me know you're out there later. So did you know that there are over 1 million environmental movements on the planet? And then it's the fastest growing movement on the earth. Why do you think that is? Here's some of the statistics in the movie that premieres August 17th, The 11th Hour. And now I just want to mention, first of all, that this is not a show about global warming. I know you've heard that before. This is more of a show about an environment in crisis. The state of our environment, the way it is right now, including economic environments and anything that surrounds having to do with our planet. Joining me is Paul Hawken. He's an environmentalist and an author of 6 books concerning the environment. He's one of the environmentalists from the film, the documentary, The 11th Hour. Welcome to the show, Paul. Thanks for joining me.
Good evening, Lisa. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with me. Thanks a lot. So why do you think that we're at this tipping point in the environment? What exactly does that mean?
I don't know that we're at the tipping point. It may be. You never know until after the fact, you know? You can't tell in real time. What we do know is that the environmental and social justice movements are converging, and there's over 1 million organizations in the world, and it's the fastest growing movement in the world, bar none. And I think the question really is, why is it not known? Why do we not see what we are doing collectively? There's 100 million people working actively every day on these issues, and it's as if we never hear about it, except, of course, headlines about, climate change right now and things.
Right. But there's 6.4 billion people on the planet, so 100 million, does that really make a difference?
Well, what other movement has 100 million people in it?
I don't know if one, obviously, that's why this is the largest.
Yeah, so 100 million people is a lot because they're educated, they're concerned, they're working full time at it, and most people are working to support themselves, their families, and well, they should. But when you look at it, I mean, there's not that many people active in the Catholic Church. There's a lot of Catholics, but I'm talking actively doing it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And So the scope and the breadth of this movement is really rather significant, and it's arising because the problems are arising, and they're arising everywhere, and the groups are arising because they're addressing the problems in place, and that's another reason we don't hear about it. And yet another reason is because there's no single leader, there's no centrality, there's no Washington, D.C. or Vatican or, you know, place where, you know, you can go to, the press can go to and get a press release or talk to the leader. This is a leaderless movement.
Well, there's also not a lot of support at all from Washington, D.C.
Well, that's true. And I think Americans have a view of the environment that is greatly colored by the political zeitgeist as well as the media. But when you get out of this country, and go to Europe and, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, and even China, by the way, which has stricter environmental standards than we do now in terms of cars and many other areas, the world is taking much more notice of it than we are and takes it much more seriously and doesn't have the scientific sort of illiteracy that seems to be so common here.
Well, it makes more of a difference when people start to get when it affects people at the basic level. There was a story in the news from the NRDC, the National Resource Defense Council, about the pollution and the beaches and the beach closings. And right. So now that it's summer and all these beaches are being deemed unsafe and there's more closures than there have ever been before. There was 25,000 closures in 2006. I don't think many people know that, but when they get there and they're hit with that, it's understood there is definitely an environmental impact, and that has to do a lot with the rains that we've been having and the runoff from the rains, but there's also some very poorly designed sewage systems that desperately need fixing.
Well, right, and when that happens in a local community, and this is a perfect case in point, there's no such thing as Republicans or Democrats. You know, oftentimes people in the conservatives will sort of tag this as a sort of a liberal issue or, you know, a do-gooder issue or the Priuset or all these names. But the fact is that whether it's a farm community or a coastal community, any time these issues affect families and people who live together and whose lives are interdependent and depend upon the quality of water and soil, the air, people come together and they begin to try to solve these problems. And those distinctions, those divisions that are sometimes, you know, projected onto this movement disappear very rapidly. And what this movement is about is not about resistance. It's about building consensus, and it is a problem-solving movement. It's trying to fix things that, in many cases, I think, as you implied earlier, should be being addressed by the government and is not. And therefore, people are doing it from the bottom up.
Which is always a great thing, because anything that's powered by the people has an amazing momentum.
I agree.
Tell us a little bit about your experience. You start and run ecological businesses. What does that mean? What does an ecological business mean? What does that
well,
mean
I think an ecological business could be two types. One is that it's a business that you, like a laundry or something, but it does it very differently. But the businesses I run have to do with fluid dynamics and engineering, and we engineer fans and turbines and rotors and, you know, pumps and industrial machinery that uses much less energy. And the designs themselves are based on nature. They're biomimetically derived from really principles that we see in nature as opposed to principles we see in mechanical engineering.
Oh, explain that, the biomimetic, the mimicry. Can you tell
it's
us
really,
a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's about learning from nature how to do things. Nature does things in a much more effective way, whether it's coatings or coloring or filtering or creating ceramics like abalone shells. You really see in nature assembly methods and materials that are created at low heat and have much stronger properties than ones that we create, more resilient, are not toxic, they can go back into the environment. So there's a very big movement right now in industrial design from GE right on down to really look. Chrysler has a box car that they made a prototype of in Europe that's based on the box fish. It's the most aerodynamic car there is. And these shapes, these designs, these materials, these ideas, these innovations are really coming from looking, going back to nature and observing how it actually works. And it's quite lovely. It's quite ingenious. And it's a fun thing. And that's what we do.
There was a really cool example that I thought I gave a great image of a spider that spins a web, mm-hmm. and then it catches the fly, and then it turns the blood of the animal into food without heating it up to 100,000 degrees like it does to make PVC, but then it converts it into energy and then makes a web that's 10 times stronger.
Yeah, the spider web is 10 times stronger than Kevlar, which is DuPont's strongest fiber for a bullet vest, and it does so at room temperature, exactly. And this is the kind of things people are looking at, because if you look at the production methods they use to create these artificial fibers, you know, it's a lot of toxic chemicals, a lot of heat, a lot of energy, and a lot of waste.
And a lot of the plants are in low-income areas where people are working and getting sick, and their families are getting sick, and they don't have choices. And
they're downwind, yeah.
Yeah, it keeps going.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I really did like about the film and what you do is that there is hope that is offered. There's solutions. There's actually real solutions that are offered, and a lot of things that people don't think about. First of all, if you are asking, what can I do to make a difference, then you're halfway there because you're aware that there's the problem.
Yes. And I couldn't agree more, because, I mean, understandably, in the 70s and 60s even, with Rachel Carson, I mean, there was a lot of people who were saying, we have a problem, you know, we have a problem, we have a problem. People, And in a sense, it became more insistent, more shrill, more loud, and environmentalists were seen as chicken littles. They were seen as people who could only talk about what was wrong and not what was right. And what we have to understand, though, is that this movement, this unnamed movement, it's not just an environmental movement, it's larger than that, but this movement to really restore the earth and to restore our relationship to it and to each other is something that is almost entirely about solutions. It's not about, you know, waving the flag and, you know, saying something's wrong. It's not about demonstrations and marches. Those occur, and those are great. But I'm just saying is that 99.9% of the activity is really sort of under the radar. And there's just really amazingly innovative things like Kiva.org, which is an organization.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where you can make direct microloans to somebody in the world. You can loan $300 to a family in Turkey or Costa Rica who wants to start a bakery, you know, to support their family, or buy a sewing machine and so forth. And it's just these elegant ways that are emerging for people to directly help people.
The stories on Kiva are amazing. The $25 restored a woman's entire hearing for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
And just from a simple hearing aid, and just to open up her window into the life. It's really, the stories are pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you something, Paul. By the way, my guest is Paul Hawken. And I was reading an interview from the filmmakers, and they said that they were surprised in doing this film to find out that humans are facing the extinction crisis, and along with all other life, but that we're not excluded from the catastrophic events and all the things that are going on. We're the most affected and the most vulnerable, even though we have the technology to you know, go to those solutions. Mm-hmm. So what they learned is that the Earth is going to be fine, but it's us humans that are in the trouble.
Yeah, the Earth will recover eventually. We have long lifespans, and we say a generation is 20 years, but really a generation is 7 years, effectively. So the feedback loops are very slow. When we see things happening with fish, with birds, with organisms that have a very short lifespan, they should be signals to us. They telegraph to us what lies ahead for us, you know, as mammalian species. And, you know, that's what Rachel Carson was saying, you know, in Silent Spring. And like I say, with humans, you know, we can say, well, what's wrong? You know, our lifespan's going up, and our houses are bigger, and our cars are bigger, and my pension fund's bigger, and, you know, what's wrong with this picture? And we don't see the underlying feedback loops that are starting to arise. And one of them, certainly in the world, is just infertility. And infertility is a feedback to a species, which is saying, you cannot reproduce. And it's rising very rapidly throughout the world, particularly in Western industrialized countries. And
what do you attribute to that?
Well, no one knows for sure. You know, and I'm not the scientist to make that pronouncement. But I would say that, you know, the fact is that we're exposed just in our food to 3,000 different chemicals that were invented since World War II. And I'm not saying they are the cause. We're exposed to a number of agents now in our shampoos and detergents and plastics and plasticizers and so forth that are disrupt our endocrine systems, our hormonal systems. We take in what's called, you know, xenoestrogenic compounds, you know. I mean, this has got to affect women. That is, the body recognizes chemicals as estrogen and sends signals to neurotransmitters. I mean, you know, this is quite a soup that we, a toxic soup that we now live in.
I thought you had a guess there. I thought you had a very educated guess about that. That's an interesting perspective when it really, as I was talking about earlier, how the environmental crisis relates to our everyday life, and that is a huge issue. We're going to take a quick break, Paul, and when we come back, we will continue to talk about some of the environmental solutions. And Paul's book is called Blessed Unrest. We'll talk a little bit about that, about this worldwide movement for social and environmental change. So we'll be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to the show. Yes, I'm Lisa. Nice to be back with you. My guest is Paul Hawken. We're talking about the environment. He is an environmentalist, author of 6 books concerning the environment, and he's one of the environmentalists from the documentary film The 11th Hour, which is coming up next weekend. It's coming out in theaters everywhere. It's a Warner Brothers released. It's a very good film, narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. So can you tell me, Paul, can you just give us an idea of some of the statistics of the global footprint that the 6.4 billion of us on this planet are making?
Well, if you measure the capacity of the Earth to produce food and fuel, and the capacity of the Earth to metabolize, or that is to treat or process our waste and carbon, right now we're at 2.4 planets. In other words, we're digging into our capital. You know, we're spending our savings. We are like, you know, trust fund babies, you know, children who are charging everything to their credit card and running down the trust fund. Because, you know, the Earth does have amazing stores of resources and capital and water. But like Barbara Kinsolver says in one of her essays, we're drinking dinosaur water. You know, we are using fossil water for that 60 million years old to, you know, to irrigate, you know, soybeans in the Midwest, you know, which are then processed into meat that goes into fast food that then, you know, in sweet causes, obesity and type 2 diabetes and so forth. I mean, we are basically drawing down the aquifer, you know, which farmers from Texas to Oklahoma and Kansas depend upon, you know, for their livelihood. And, you know, we're drilling deeper and the pumps are working harder and so forth. And that's just one example, really, of we say, well, what's wrong? Everything's okay. And the best analogy is if you're going across, say, the Nevada desert and you're going at 70 miles an hour and somebody says, look, I think we're running out of gas. And the driver says, no. And then it pushes on the accelerator and goes 100 miles per hour and says, see, there's nothing wrong. So what we have is a civilization that's speeding up its use of resources and the creation of waste with no real accounting of how much is left, where it's coming from, and where those wastes are going.
You know, I wonder if it's just a lack of education, and the education's out there. But once again, when you take 100 million people and you compare that to 6.4 billion, I don't know what the percentage is. Someone can do that for me. But the idea is there enough information getting out there? Take the rainforest example. There, it's very commonly known. There's a lot of people that know about the clear cutting and that that's an issue. But do people really know that the rainforests are the climate control centers of the world? That's where our climate comes from. It's the brain.
Right. No, that's right. They don't know about respiration. They don't know that, you know, there goes Brazil goes, there goes all of European agriculture. And then there goes food prices for the rest of the world. And then we go into permanent food crisis. And again, which you've touched upon here, which I think is very important, is that when we often hear about an issue, we'll hear about it like, well, that's a problem over there. That's a Brazilian problem. That's an Amazonian problem. And what we don't see and we're not informed about is your point, which is everything is really connected. This Earth is one system. And admittedly, our understanding of the systemic connections and how it all works and fits is not perfect. It's growing at a great rate, and understanding is increasing. But as it does so, we become more alarmed at where we're finding out as opposed to less.
So now look at the junk mail that we get. We get how many pieces of junk mail do you get in your mailbox? Or have you found a way to stop that? Because
I have not.
I just put the recycle bin next to the mailbox now.
I walk from my mailbox because the recycling bin is 30 feet away. I sort my mail right there.
Right.
And yeah, it's exactly right. And that's just what a perfect. And everybody loses because the person mailing that thing to you and me also lost.
Right. Because so, I never read it.
Yeah, the forest lost. I mean, economically, it's a dead net loss.
Do you know how to get off the junk mail circuit? Because I know there's a way that you can get off of the sales calls to your cell phone. You can call a number for that. But how do you get the junk mail?
The National Registry, the Direct Marketing Association, says they'll do it, but it's always behind. And it's kind of like going to the Fox and saying, can you take care of the chickens? Because mm-hmm. the Direct Mail Association is the industry that sends you all the junk mail. And so it doesn't work very well. I gave a talk to the post office once and suggested that they actually sell nega mail. And nega means nothing mail. And what that means is that you and I would get a form from the post office and said, this is the things we do want, you know, catalogs on, you know, outdoor clothing. But we don't want credit card solicitations. We don't want this. We just check it off. We send it to them. And then that is sold to direct marketers and say, look at this person. Lisa Garr says she does not want any of these things, but she does want this. Okay. And they could use that, and then they could sell your name every time. And then basically everybody would benefit, and you wouldn't get those things, and they would save money. And the post office would make money by shipping no mail. And they actually listened, and they said, no, we can't do that.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, in the film it said that 100 million trees are being destroyed a year. So in the next 60 seconds that I'm speaking, 5 acres of 2,000-year-old trees will be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like the issue is, as we're talking, right now.
I mean, literally, we receive catalogs that are made of ancient forests.
Yeah, 2,000-year-old ancient forest. But then when you go to the corporations and you try to explain, because that really is who needs to be, this needs to be explained to the corporations that are producing 100 million catalogs a year or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know the company.
But
it's a lingerie, women's lingerie company.
Yeah, that was.
A year. And what they'll say, and they stopped after years and years of pressure, and what they said was, well, these are the branches of the trees we're making the catalogs of.
What? Oh, no.
The trees are actually made into timber. And,
well, just leave the trees there and then cut the branch. That's fine. You can prune them, but not cut them down. But you know what? In the same breath here, Paul, I don't want to make the loggers or the truckers that make a living carrying the load of trees, which might be happening right now on our highways. I don't want to make them wrong.
Hey, tell that to the loggers in Oregon and Washington, because that was the argument that was used by the forest industry, you know, to the environmentalists. And now all those mills are shut because the timber companies went in there, they cut it, they sold off the land, and they left and closed the mills, and those people are unemployed. So what environmentalists have been trying to propose and talk about is sustainable yield, so that loggers and truckers have a job that they can depend on year after decade after generation.
What are sustainable yields? What do you mean by that?
Well, forests can be harvested. I mean, they can be harvested.
So pruned instead of cut down is
not
an example.
You can take logs out, and actually forests will benefit from selective logging. It opens up space. It opens up for new logs. You want uneven stands. You don't want stands of timber. They're all the same age. They're very susceptible to disease then. And so by harvesting in an ongoing way, using, you know, basically sustainable forestry methods, and then actually there is more economic prosperity in those areas where there's timber than there would be and has been by the old methodology. So this idea that, again, that environmentalists are against jobs, you know, is really not true. What has killed jobs in the forest industry in this country has been the forest products companies.
Now, this is the point that is enlightening, and I forgot we have to take a break here. So I'm getting into this conversation. So hang on with me. Paul Hawken is my guest. We will be right back. You're listening to Lisa Garr. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is Paul Hawken. He's the author of a book called Blessed Unrest. We've just been talking about environmental issues. Paul, what about legalizing hemp in the U.S.? Because hemp can be used for paper, clothing, a lot of different things that trees can also be used for.
Right.
What do you think about that issue?
I think it's a great issue. I mean, the Constitution is written on hemp. So,
great answer.
So, I mean, you go to Philadelphia, that's what you're looking at, is hemp.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it has a venerable history, and it has the amount of THC, the active ingredient in cannabis sativa, which is marijuana, is so tiny that you'd have to inhale a whole acre, you know. And so it's just a non-issue. And here is a perfect example of, you know, bureaucratic, you know, bandstanding and showboating and this and that, and everybody getting righteous about drugs. You know, they're pouring in from Afghanistan. And meanwhile, this is a crop that our farmers can grow and make money at, and it does not require a lot of, you know, fertilizer. It requires no pesticides whatsoever.
Really?
No, none. And nothing. Insects don't eat it. And even if they did, it wouldn't matter because we don't eat it. It's actually used for fiber, for clothing, as you said.
Can't the industrial processes of hemp be legalized and the abusive processes be illegal? I mean, can you do that? You can't, can you?
Yeah, well, no. I mean, the states
be ways.
Now are Pennsylvania. The states are petitioning the government saying the states want to legalize it. It's the federal government that's preventing it. So we're bringing our hemp in from China. You know, I mean, the clothing, the fiber, mm-hmm. the seeds, the nuts, the oil. I mean, everything on a hemp plant can be used. It is one of the most incredible plants on earth. And we, you know, are subsidizing cotton grown in the desert using water from the Colorado River instead.
See, you know, that's interesting. But how are things like hemp seeds and stuff like that being legally sold here?
Oh, if you go to the Whole Foods and natural stores, people like that, you'll see a whole foods hemp nut. Bread, hemp seed, hemp seed oils. You'll see it in cosmetics and lotions. You'll see it in butters. I mean, it's a food. It's been a food for thousands of years.
So it's legal here as a food, but it's not legal.
But you can't grow it. An Iowa farmer can't grow it in his fields and sell it to the people who are processing it here by getting it from overseas. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, I met a really interesting green catering company when I was at that screening, and they make cups out of corn mm-hmm. and forks and spoons and, like, hangers out of wheat. Mm-hmm. Think about hangers. I mean, how many hangers does each person have in their house? Those are all toxic elements. And the interesting thing is we just completely take that for granted, and they're toxic to produce, whereas there's other ways and other means of doing things like this.
Yes. I mean, if you go to sites like worldchanging.com on the web and you just start reading again about the designs, the innovation, I think Bruce Mao is in 11th Hour, and he has a site called Massive Change and a really wonderful book by the same name. And when you start to pour into the new materials, the engineering, the designs, the ingeniousness of not just Americans, but people all over the world in terms of what we can do with what we have and actually create a more livable world, than we have now. It's not going backwards, what we're talking about. We're talking about innovation, change. And again, you know, what's interesting because, Lisa, you know, business benefits from change. And really, if you look back and you look at what environmentalists are asking for, is change. The change from a carbon-based economy based on fossil fuels to one based on hydrogen and solar and wind and many other alternative sources is a wellspring, immense wellspring of jobs and technology and, you know, living wage, family jobs for Americans. I mean, there's the Apollo Project, which is working with unions to try to increase the rate of alternative energy technology in this country. Instead, we're spending money and sending our best men and women over there to get shot at and killed to, you know, protect an oil field that we could be creating an alternative for here, and those men and women, instead of being in danger and getting post-traumatic stress syndrome could be here creating a healthy country and healthy communities.
Well, let me ask you something about our environment here in terms of weather. Is there seeding going on? Do you know about weather machines? What do you know about that?
Well, I think I think this goes back to climate itself. I mean, weather, climate. I mean, and what I want to say is that we're at a funny situation because in my work, you have to in your work, you have to track what's going on in your business. You have to know, or you're not going to be very relevant. In my work, I have to do the same thing. And that's the environment, and part of it's climate, and part of it's to track the data, you know, what's coming in and all this sort of stuff. And what we see is a real lag time between the data that's coming in, when it's peer-reviewed, when it's published, when it makes Science Tuesday in the New York Times, and finally makes it to CNN or Fox or, you know, MSNBC or something like that. And we're looking out, we're saying, whoa, the data that's coming is really significant. Now, so significant that I don't think there's any question that we will be talking seriously, soon, about artificial ways to change weather, to prevent some of the effects of climate change, because I don't think we'll have a choice. But I don't know of any efforts that are undergoing that are secret, because they wouldn't be known to me anyway. But in terms of technologies, there's a whole bunch of ideas that are, some are quite interesting, some are just lunatic, but that about really changing the weather, preventing heat from rising in the earth and so forth, and even generating rainfall using different types of technologies.
Yeah. So that does exist. That's really, I know it exists.
Proven. And I mean, there was in World War One. There was these machines that, you know, think of a smoke ring, you know, and that's a toroid, and these machines would blow these toroids up in the air towards enemy airplane, enemy aircraft, and they would, if it hit an aircraft, this air, this puff of air, would knock it right out of there. It would knock the wings right off, and the plane would crash. Well, one of the things they noticed is when they were doing this is that it was creating rainfall. And, you know, it was like a side effect, you know, but that's not what they were trying to do. They were trying to shoot down enemy aircraft. And of course, when the aircraft became faster and made of steel, then that technology was sort of put away. And this is one of the little, you know, hidden stories of warfare. But what happened is they were creating rain.
And well, now, we're in these places of drought now. I mean, in some severe areas of drought. Why isn't that being used?
I don't know. I mean, you think Australia would be all over it. You know, they have for the 500-year drought right now. And the prime minister said we should pray. And this is the one who didn't want to sign the Kyoto Protocol. And so it's a very good question.
Well, if the technology's there, and we know it's there.
Yeah.
It's not new. I mean, you can find it on the Internet. So, all right. So, I mean, this is the data that sometimes scares me, is that things are getting worse faster than expected. Human civilization has not even shown any sign of slowing down with our consumption of the Earth's resources.
Correct.
So the outcome, it doesn't look good.
Not on the face of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I wrote the book Blasted Unrest, and that's why I so much appreciate the last, you know, 40% of 11th Hour, because it's really important to know what the problem is. But at the same time, it's even more important than to, that allows you to understand the solutions that are forthcoming and are there right now, ready to be implemented by far-seeing and governments, by true leaders, by people who have been awakened to the problem and who want to continue to be here and be a civilization. And I don't want to talk in apocalyptic terms, but I do want to say that what we have to understand is that warming is not the issue. It's the volatility is the issue. The climate gets more volatile, you know, like this 500-year drought in Australia. And I saw this year, just on my homepage, you know, there's three headlines right in a row on BBC. You know, record fires in Eastern Europe.
Yes.
That was one. Record floods in the UK and Germany. Record cold in the Andes, and hundreds of indigenous people who've been there for 1,000 years were dying. And all 1, 2, 3, and exactly. That's it. Which is, and you can never scientifically say it's due to climate change.
Well, you could also say, though, what about the argument that the records did not exist several thousands of years ago. I mean, there's
Absolutely.
That whole argument there. We just have a minute left, but what do you say about that?
Then I would say look at the science of the ice core, you know, the cores that have been drilled that go down 400,000 or 500,000 years, where we can detect carbon levels and temperature, and we do know that the carbon levels now are the highest they've been in 600,000 years.
That's true, with 6.4 billion people on the planet.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we do know that.
It is a very big increase. Well, your website, is it wiseerearth.org?
Wiseerearth.org is the data about these organizations and what they're doing.
Great.
Oh, yeah.
And then the movie is called The 11th Hour. It's coming out this weekend. And
it's a wonderful movie.
Yeah. Paul Hawken is one of the environmentalists talking on the film. Thank you so much for joining me. And his book, again, is called Blessed Unrest. It's about this exact movement, this worldwide movement for social and environmental change that is a sleeper movement. It's fascinating. So thank you so much again, Paul, for joining me today.
Lisa, thank you.
All right, take care. And we will be back. Up next, we'll take a look at some of the new sciences that are emerging from cutting-edge scientists like Dr. Bruce Lipton. This is Lisa Garr. We'll be right back. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.